when y'all said you had a brief introduction to your meeting, you weren't kidding. My name is Laura.
Hi, Laura.
I am an alcoholic. Thanks for having me. So I have a sobriety date, I have a home group, I have a sponsor, and my sponsor has a sponsor. How about all that? I just might stay sober today. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period of time, we get worse, never better. And I'm a very good example of that statement. This is my story. This is what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So looking around the room, I see many of you might remember the summer of 1969. It was a pretty important summer. We walked on the moon that summer. Over 350,000 people celebrated love, peace, and rock and roll at Woodstock. The Beatles performed their last concert. Even Brian Adams sung about it. Something else happened that summer. Ivan and Cookie had a baby. I can claim that to be the only person in the world whose parents' names are Ivan and Cookie. And no, they are not Russian spies. So I was welcomed into the world on June 28, 1969, to much fanfare, the only child of Ivan and Cookie Wright. There was even a custom sign made, and it was put on top of my parents' inn, and it said, "It's a girl," and it was a happy day. But in order for you to understand who I am and my disease, you need to understand Ivan and Cookie just a little bit, so I'm going to spend about 5 minutes talking about them. So Cookie was my mom. And when I was born, she was 20-something firefighter's widow. She had three children. They were 10, 9, and 7. She was absolutely stunning. The kind of woman that walks into the room and owns it. She had crystal blue eyes, blonde hair, and a body that could stop a train. And one day it did. It stopped a train named Ivan. 6 months after her firefighter husband died in a fire. She was fallen from grace. She was the black sheep of her family. And she was a hopeless alcoholic. Ivan, who hailed from San Pedro, California. My mother was from New York City. He was the fallen son of a Navy officer. He dropped out in his 11th grade year at military school, much like my mother had dropped out of parochial school about 11th grade. He was handsome, charming, smart, and hopelessly alcoholic. So along came little Laura. I became the fourth of four children, but the only one between these two. So I got the genetic jackpot. From the time I was born, I was put on display. I was the princess of the inn, the child of the day, and I learned very, very early that you smile when you're sad, and you always look good. From the time I was born to be on display. My parents had a bassinet made for me. It was in the lobby of their inn. And when I wasn't crying or dirty or hungry, I was dressed like an angel in the middle of all of that lace, and my parents would say, "Look at our beautiful daughter." When I turned into a regular kid, and I needed to be changed, or I was hungry, or I cried, my 9-year-old sister was beckoned to come get me, take care of me, mother me, and bring me back when I was perfect. As time went on, I kind of grew up in this environment. I was spoiled rotten. I was taught big words. I was reading by the time I was 3. I could write in cursive by the time I was 4. My father showed me off as a prodigy. I was very, very scared all the time that I was going to disappoint. That I was going to disappoint him. That I was going to disappoint my mother. I spent most of my time before school in a high chair at the end of a bar. Our inn did have a bar. Of course, you're 2 alcoholics, you're going to have a fully stocked bar. Where I ate maraschino cherries and cheese slices and had a pretty good life, I guess. Well, as what will happen when you have 2 alcoholics and about $1 million, they went through it in about 4 years. And the inn went bankrupt. So, for whatever reason, they relocated us to Arizona from New Hampshire. That's a really big change. So at 5 years old, I moved to Mesa, Arizona. And that's when things in my childhood really went south. I had 2 very, very active alcoholic parents. They were very violent with each other. Love and hate run a very tight wire, and they crossed it a lot. My father was fond of guns. He fancied himself a cowboy now that he was in Arizona, wore a cowboy hat and all of those things, all 5'6" of him. He was just a badass. Always had a gun on his side, in his car, under his pillow. Those guns came out when Daddy drank, and there were times when I'd wake up in the morning and there'd be holes in the ceiling. There was a time when the neighbors had to come over and get us out of our bedrooms because Ivan was running around the neighborhood drunk with a gun. But this was Arizona, and this was the 1970s, and you didn't call the police back then. You just sort of policed yourself out there in the desert at the base of the Superstition Mountains. Every once in a while, the police would come, like on my 7th birthday. Daddy woke up in jail. Really wasn't his fault. If he hadn't ducked, that ashtray would have never hit him in the head. And then he would have never gotten picked up for domestic violence. My mom was always the instigator. By the time I was 9 years old, my parents had divorced, as you can imagine. At this point, I was raising myself. I had some teenage siblings. My oldest brother was married and gone. My other brother and sister, you know, they were in high school. And I was pretty much raising myself. My mother worked on the weekends, ran around with men during the week, and spent a lot of time in bars. It never occurred to me that my parents did not love me. As an adult, it occurs to me that my parents just simply did not know how to parent. So basically, I was raised by my sister, who is 9 years older than me, and I was scared all the time. I was different. I felt different. I never quite fit in. I was just scared. A lot, because I never had any security. Well, back in the late 70s and the early 80s, we didn't have the internet for dating. Katie bar the door if we did, because Cookie Wright would have been hooking up with some of y'all. That woman was the most male-dependent person on the planet. And I'm not speaking ill of the dead. My mother was beautiful, and she was brilliant. And she taught me to be strong. But she was male dependent because that's just the way she was raised. So back then, a good way to find yourself a man, apparently, was in the back of, like, some magazine where there were personal ads. Well, not only was my mother male dependent, she was a sucker for a story. So she ended up writing to some man in prison. And he was going to be the love of her life. I was 11 years old, and she packed me up with my older brother and sister. And we stayed at KOAs and came across this country and ended up in the Ozarks in West Plains, Missouri. If you've never been to West Plains, Missouri, you ain't missing nothing. When I moved there, the population was about 5,000 and the generations went way back. So I was, again, the outsider, the outcast. Didn't know anybody, scared to death. This is when my mom hit her bottom, and it's important in my story. That summer, of course, I know that you're shocked when I tell you that the relationship between the ex-convict Gene and my mother lasted 3 weeks. I know that's shocking. We thought it was going to be a forever love story. So now it was time for her to step up and figure out what she was going to do with her 3 children in this rural town where she had no money. My siblings had trust funds. Her firefighter husband had been from a very wealthy family. When he passed, trust funds had been set up for them. And that was another way that I was an outsider. I wasn't one of them. I was just normal. I didn't come from aristocracy. I can't trace my lineage back to the Mayflower, which my sister still to this day rubs in my face. But so she would tap into their trust funds. She would make them write letters about something or other on why they needed the money. And this is how we lived for the entire part of her final descent into madness. She moved us 4 times that summer. You know, those geographics. If I just move out to the country and get a farmhouse, everything will be just fine. We lived there about 2 weeks before she hooked up with a motorcycle gang, ran off for 2 weeks, left us all alone with no food, no car, and no money, 7 miles down a dirt road. Those weeks in the farmhouse changed me. Those weeks in that farmhouse scared me. She finally did come back. And I think she started changing. She realized what she had done. She'd run away from her children many, many times, but never for that long, and never left us alone. I guess she thought, because the older ones were 17 and 18, and I was 11, that somehow we'd be all right living on some popcorn and Cheese Whiz. To this day, I don't like Cheese Whiz. So then she decided it would get better if we moved into town. So we moved into town, and we were there about a month. We moved right before Christmas. We were there about a month before my brother and sister had it. There had been at least 3 or 4 different men in and out. Still wasn't working. I don't think at this point we had any heat. It was near Christmas time, and I woke up one morning and Mom was gone. Mom was just gone. I said, "Where's Mama?" "She's not here." And as the story goes, they had had enough and they kicked her out because she threatened to leave, and she packed that blue Samsonite suitcase of hers that she would always pack. She packed that in her makeup and they said, "Go." And they locked the door behind her. Later that night, that beautiful, intelligent, broken woman was walking down the middle of Main Street, drunk, stumbling, with 2 suitcases, and she was picked up by the local authorities and given a choice. You can go to rehab, or you can go to jail and lose your kids. She chose rehab, and thank God. The rest of her story is her story, but let me tell you that I was introduced to AA at the age of 12. And my mother died sober with 13 years of sobriety. So that's the good part of the story. Now, Ivan, on the other hand, stayed in Arizona, kind of an absent father. I know that he loved me. He drank until the day he died. Hopeless alcoholic. There was nothing that could be done there. So, I was raised in AA. I was the AA kid. My mom became a drug and alcohol counselor at the local rehab center. She would haul my little butt in there to talk to all those teenage girls. "Look at my daughter. She doesn't smoke. She doesn't drink. She's going to college. She has a boyfriend. She's perfect. On display again. On display again. I didn't want to mess up. I didn't want to make a mistake. But then at 15 years old, I made a big mistake. I was part of the speech and debate team. I actually was the state champion for the I'm trying to think of the word. I was the state championship person in speaking, and I can't think of the word. Oratory. I did oratory, and I won a state championship for that. That's a 6 to 8 minute persuasive speech. I was very good. I had found my niche, you know. I never really fit in school. I just wasn't one of those girls. The boys hated me. They always made fun of me. And the girls, I think, felt sorry for me. And, you know, so I just did, but I found this thing that I loved. And so I went all across the state on these speech and debate trips. I was 15 years old. I can't remember what time of year it was. Probably the fall, I would think. And there was a girl. I was a sophomore. She was a senior. And her name was Michelle. And I thought she was the coolest thing ever. She drank and she ran around with boys. And she was pretty. And she came from the wrong side of the tracks. And the boys used to follow her around like little puppy dogs. And I wanted to be just like Michelle. And she was really smart. And so Michelle and I started palling around on this trip. And, of course, you know, you got a bunch of teenage kids. You put them in a hotel, 4 to a room. And Michelle, who was 18 at the time, hooked up with some boys that worked at the hotel. And they were wrapping up some sort of party, supposedly cleaning it up. Well, there was an open bar. Michelle said, let's go party with these boys. Well, I wanted to be just like Michelle, and I had never tasted alcohol in my life, unless you count that time when I was 3 years old in my diaper and went up and asked Daddy if I could taste his beer, because I swore I was never going to drink. I was never going to be like my mom. I was never going to do that. I was going to make something of my life. I drank that night for the very first time. I blacked out that night for the very first time. I threw up that night from drinking for the very first time. And it's a horrible story, and I'm not going to go into a whole lot of details about it except to tell you that I woke up alone, scared, and crying in a hotel room with absolutely no idea what had happened. I called the front desk. Said I was part of this group. They said, it's okay. We know you're there. You've got a late checkout. Somebody will be up to get you shortly. Take a shower. I looked in the mirror. My eyes were swollen. I was sick. My whole body hurt. My whole little 15-year-old body hurt. Knock at the door. I open the door. There's my coach, my speech and debate coach, and a police officer. And I have no idea what's going on. To this day, I don't know if I know what happened that day. And I know I only have flashes of what happened that night. But I got drugged down to the police station. I was asked to identify the man that raped me. My mother did not come to my aid. There was no one in the police department except me and the police officers, who were not nice people. Because this was 1984, and the Me Too movement hadn't started yet. I got kicked out of school for 2 weeks. Everyone in school knew what happened. I was shunned, I was shamed, and I was told I was broken and ruined. And I could have taken that and I could have gone down the road of Michelle's road. I could have partied and I could have given up on life, but that's not my style. So I got obstinate. And that alcoholic ego reared its ugly head at 15. And I said, screw all of you. I'm going to go to college, and I'm going to be successful, and I'm going to live in New York City, and I'm going to write a book, and I'm going to run the world. and you all will be sorry. I didn't end up running the world yet. I'm not running the world yet. I went to college, normal college drinking. I remember when my mom was driving me up to college, she said, "Now, Laura Lee, nobody up here knows you. This is your opportunity to reinvent yourself and be a good girl." You know what I heard? You're still not good enough. Whoever is in that body still isn't good enough. Be someone else. And oh, Lord, that first year I tried. I didn't drink. I didn't run around with boys. I studied. I joined the best sorority. I tried so hard. And I was lonely and scared and exhausted. And I went to the doctor and I said, "I can't, college is so hard." And they put me on some pills. I never went home because I chose a college that was like really far away from where my mom lived, which is probably on purpose. So all my girlfriends and sorority sisters would go home for the weekends, and I was just always kind of there on campus. It was a little school, kind of like Bridgewater, only it was in northern Missouri, and it snowed a lot. We partied because all the frat houses were off campus, and we would party, but there was always somebody that partied harder than me. So it was like, I think I skipped that alcohol thing, you know, because she's over there throwing up. I'm not throwing up. I may be drinking some Peachtree Schnapps out of this bottle, and it may be warm and taste nasty, but I'm not an alcoholic. I drink the good stuff. You know, Boone's Farm. You know what I'm talking about. So I never really got into a lot of trouble in high school or college with alcohol. But when I drank alcoholically. So I got out of college. I graduated from college in May of 1991. I was 8 and a half months pregnant with my daughter, Mary. I was not married. Her biological father was a raging alcoholic because that's the only kind of guy I like to hook up with. And when he was putting vodka and orange Kool-Aid one morning, I was like, I can't do this. Because remember, my alcoholism hadn't come into bloom yet. So I'm like, I can't have a kid with somebody that's an alcoholic. That's the way I grew up. I can't have that. So I left him and went home. I graduated, went home, had my baby, became a single mom. I had a couple of degrees at this point, one in journalism, one in economics. It was 1991, and if you remember that, we were in an economic downturn, and so it was very difficult for new graduates to find a job. So I worked at Pizza Hut with my two degrees. I was proud, very proud to fill that salad bar. But I was really determined to support my daughter, and I tried very hard. And I failed. I was a good mom, but I couldn't support her. I just couldn't pay the bills. And I called my dad, and I said, "Dad, the electric's going to get cut off. I don't know what to do." I was 21 years old. And he said, "Well, Laura, sounds like that's your problem. You grew up, got yourself pregnant, and now you're a mother. I guess you're going to have to figure it out." Oh, I'm mad at him. The best thing he could have ever done for me. Because it taught me to rely on absolutely no one but myself. If you can't rely on your parents, then you can't rely on anybody. So I became very, very independent. Now, Mom did kind of come to the rescue. She came up and got me and Mary. And, you know, I lived with her for about 3 or 4 months. She, of course, was sober. It was good. I got a job in radio, so I became a radio broadcaster, and I did that for 15 years. And I was a good mom, and I didn't drink, and I didn't run around, and I never went out, and I worked really hard. And I did date, but I always kept it away from my daughter because I was desperately searching for this rich man that was going to save my world because I was raised to believe that that's what pretty girls did. You found the rich guy, and you lived happily ever after. So in my position, I was able to meet congressmen and senators and lawyers and doctors. And I met a young man who was an investment banker, and he was running for Congress, and I fell madly in love with him. But someone like that doesn't marry someone like me. For 5 years, I pretended that it would go somewhere, but it didn't. So by the time I was in my late 20s with a 5-year-old, I decided, dang, it's about time I got married. Isn't that what society demands at this point? So as luck would have it, in a bar one night, and I wasn't a big drinker at this point, which was interesting, but I was in a bar that night with a friend. We went to listen to a band. I met a man who would later become my husband. I met him. I was engaged to him within 2 weeks, married to him within 3 months, and we had our first child within the first year of our marriage. I stayed married to that man for 21 years. He was a really good alcoholic, still is. He could probably teach classes on it. But that's the thing, is I was married to him, and I said, I don't have a problem. He's got the problem. We had 3 boys in 5 years, so I'm the proud mother of 4 children, 3 boys, and a daughter. When my youngest son was about 6, I finally threw in the towel and said, you know what? I can't stop him from drinking, and I like drinking, so I'm just going to drink with him. And I did. And so that was about 11 years ago. And that began my downhill slide into this wonderful thing we call active alcoholism. So we pretended that we were doing high-class things. We'd go to the wineries, right? And that was our hobby. Well, this is our hobby. I'm studying wine. No, I was drinking wine. I was drinking a lot of wine. I used to tell people, oh, I just love wine. I love how it's made. I love to watch the grapes get crushed. That was all just alcoholic ego. It was my excuse to drink wine. And I drank a lot of it. And then I discovered vodka. Vodka. Ugh. This was fabulous. And then I discovered this wine that you could get at the Trump Vineyards called Cru, which is, anyway, you mix it with vodka, and it's like craziness. So I became a daily drinker. My husband and I were both daily drinkers. My husband, when he would drink, could get very violent. So halfway through our marriage, what was a good marriage turned into a very bad marriage, a very violent marriage, a very scary marriage. And so I got back into my fear. I'm scared all the time because I never know whether I'm going to say something and he's going to be nice, or I'm going to say something and I'm going to get thrown against the wall and choked. I don't know. Because he doesn't know. Because he's sick and he has a disease. So that went on, and we tried to raise our children as best we could. I think we did a pretty good job. We both had great jobs. We made good money. And I think that that was part of the problem. Maybe we would have both gotten well, or at least I might have gotten well a little faster, if things on the outside didn't seem okay. We had the big house. We had the new cars. We had the money. We had everything that I thought life was supposed to be like, except we had no God. We had no spirit in our house. I had a big Bible that I kept on a stand in the entryway to my big house. And I never looked at it. It was there for show. Everything in my life from the day I was born was about the show. And things needed to change. I had a great job. I made a lot of money. I was a corporate executive. I traveled the country. I was always on a plane. I always had a martini. Things were looking good. I stayed in the best hotels. As a matter of fact, I was just up in D.C. and I looked across and saw the Ritz-Carlton and I go, oh, I remember when I stayed there. That was a bad scene. It was always a bad scene. I remember standing on the balcony of a D.C. hotel, and at this point, I'd become very bored in my marriage, and my husband traveled all the time, and I had started taking lovers. And, because we travel a lot, particularly I spent a lot of time in D.C., and so I thought, well, let's see what this firefighter obsession is about. So I got a firefighter lover, and so he's in the room, and I've got my cocktail, and I'm on the balcony and I'm smoking a cigarette and I'm thinking, life doesn't get any better than this, does it? I'm making all the money. I've got a 6'4" well-built fireman in my hotel room, a husband at home, and some healthy kids. It doesn't get any better than this. And you know what? That night I really just wanted to jump off that balcony because I was really, really empty. My soul was empty. And I had no idea what was wrong with me. So this pattern of behavior went on for 4 years. I would travel. I would run around on my husband. I would drink. I would come home. I would drink. He would drink. We would fight. Invariably, he would try to beat me up. My boys were growing at this point and becoming very defensive of mother. My daughter had moved out. Peace out, Mom. I can't do this anymore. I can't be the grown-up anymore. And I get it now, looking back. But remember, I didn't have the problem. I wasn't the alcoholic. He was. He was the problem. I was perfectly fine. I was making the money. I was supporting the family. I was taking us on fancy trips. I was perfect. How dare you tell me I have a problem? I earned this drink. You don't know what mommy does every day. You don't know how hard it is to get on a plane. It's like really hard to go up those steps, get on that plane, get served a cocktail. Some hard stuff. It had gotten to the point where I think the last time my husband came after me, and I was not innocent in this. I have a very smart mouth. That does not say that a man has a right to try to strangle his wife because she has a smart mouth. But I was not some shrinking violet in the corner who was being abused by a big, mean man. But the last time he came after me, my two youngest sons were asleep on the couch. Thank you. It's with my runny nose. Thank you. Yes. I can't help it. I'm sorry. It's so cold in here. My two youngest boys were asleep on the couch and woke up during this altercation and tried to get him off of me. And I'm going to say they were probably around 10 and 11 at that time because these last two are 12 months apart. And they couldn't. I married a bodybuilder, an ex-football player. They weren't going to move him. So my 15-year-old son comes downstairs and finally gets his dad off of me. And then there becomes an altercation between those two. Something in me snapped that night. Now, I didn't get sober that night, but I decided I wasn't going to be married anymore. As soon as he turned on my kids, that was it. Right? So our marriage started to disintegrate, and we started moving toward divorce. But I moved out for a while and then came back. You know how that goes. This kind of boomerang thing. But I would still go and I would drink at work. I was a salesperson. I was a sales executive. All the big boys drank and I was one of the few women managers and I tried to keep up with them. I would stay up and drink with them till 3 a.m. and then get up and, do my job. It was exhausting and I wasn't cut out for it. And I got myself in trouble because little girls don't run around with VPs in a drunken environment and expect everything to be on the up and up and in the kosher world. It's not going to happen. So bad things happened. Things that shouldn't have happened. And nothing stays quiet forever. So I ended up losing a really good job that supported my family, that made me feel important, because I was a drunk and I couldn't keep it together long enough to be a decent human being. I got a settlement from the company because the vice president was involved and he was drunk too, and I was a girl and he was my superior. So I had a little chunk of money, decided now was when I was going to leave my husband. I'm going to do some soul searching. This was not enough to get me sober, people. I was going to go do some soul searching. I was going to figure this out. I drove up the coast of California by myself. I left the kids, you know, back with him. And I drove up PCH. I spent 2 weeks out in California finding myself. The only thing I found was more alcohol and the decision that I just really didn't want to be married to this guy anymore, and I was certain that I could do it better on my own. Then I came back, I had to get a job. He moved to South Carolina, so now it's just me and my two boys. My other boy has moved out because, you know, they get 18. You got two drunk parents, you're going to peace out. So I got a job over here in Charlottesville at a little startup. And, you know, my alcoholic ego, I was absolutely sure that I'd be running the place before too long. I know everything there is to know about technology and sales, and I'm an expert. Please. What God started to do with me at that point was make me pliable. He started chipping away at that ego of mine and showing me that there were things in this world that were far more important than the human existence and money and carnal pleasures and the high of alcohol. But I needed to go a little bit farther down. So I didn't hit bottom, I hit the basement. I had a horrible job. It was a telemarketing job, basically. I mean, they called it sales executive, but it was not sales executive. I made 100 phone calls a day. Absolutely hated it. Didn't make hardly any money compared to what I was making. I couldn't pay my bills. I was just miserable. Drove to Charlottesville every day, drove home, got drunk every night, got up, did the same thing over and over and over and over until I wanted to die. 3 weeks before I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I tried to slip my wrists. I was done. I was done. I couldn't stand the pain anymore. I couldn't stand the disappointment in myself because I was never going to be good enough. I was always going to be that trashy little girl from West Plains, Missouri, the broken one. No matter how big my job, no matter how good looking my husband, no matter how big my house, I was always going to be broken. And so I was just done. One of my very best friends is a police officer in Baltimore. And he has been by my side through this entire journey. And I texted him that night that I slipped my one wrist. And I sent him a picture of it. And he was very angry with me because I put him in a really bad position. Because as a law enforcement officer, he really was required to have someone come to my house to my assistance. I managed to get him not to do that. But I realized when I woke up the next morning, something had to change. Because I had children and people that depended on me, and I had become her. I had become Cookie. The one thing I said I was never going to do, I had absolutely become her. So what did Cookie do when shit got real? She went to AA. So I had one friend that was in the program. I called him up, and I just happened to know he was in the program. It was just was. And I look back on it now and realize it was meant to be. And I said, I think I need one of your meetings. And I was sort of joking. And then I went upstairs and I went to my bookcase and I found this book. Now, I believe, if I'm correct, this is the third edition of Alcoholics Anonymous. My mom mom and dad bought this sometime in the 70s when they were going to get sober. When I got this book, it was brand new. It had the cover on it, and it had never even had, the spine wasn't even broken. This was not my mom's big book. Why I have this big book and why it was on my shelf is a mystery today. Why I've kept this for 35 years is a mystery today. Every one of my books is in a box in my basement, except for anything I bought recently and this big book. I went up and got this big book, and I started reading it, and I started crying. And I don't mean pretty crying. I mean ugly crying. The first chapter of this book is stained with my tears. And I mean that it is stained with my tears. And I realized that I was in this book. And I wasn't Cookie. I was Laura, and I was an alcoholic, and I was sick, and I was spiritually bankrupt, and I was a horrible person, and I couldn't bill myself as a great mother and a fantastic wife because I could make cookies and wrap Christmas presents. I sucked as a human being, and I wanted to change. I wanted to change that day more than I've ever wanted anything. And so I walked into the club in Harrisonburg, Virginia on a winter's evening, scared out of my mind. And like so many stories I've heard before, I cried through the whole meeting, have absolutely no idea what anybody said, but I went back the next day. And I remember my buddy who goes to meetings in Stanton. He said, "Okay, now you got to do 90 and 90. What? I went to a meeting. Aren't I better? I sat with y'all. I said, I'm an alcoholic. I didn't drink today. You know, I'm all live and let live one day at a time. You know, let go, let God. What do you mean 90 and 90? I don't have time for all that. Have a life." I did 120 and 90. Because what I found when I walked into the fellowships of AA is I found kindred spirits. I found acceptance. I found God. And you could call your higher power whatever you want. I choose to call him God. I found God in the yellow walls of the club in Harrisonburg. And by the way, I am now a member of that club, and we're going to paint those walls some other color. They just remind me of a nicotine-stained grandma's house. But I went to that club, and I was working in Charlottesville, so I have to give a lot of props to the people in Charlottesville as well, the AA groups in Charlottesville, because I would go to a noon meeting in Charlottesville every day. And then I would go to the club every night. And that was my routine. Instead of going home and getting drunk and waking up barely able to function the next day, I went to the club and I got some AA and I went home and I went to bed and I did it all over again and all over again and all over again. And I did get on a pink cloud and I thought everything was going to be fantastic. Things were going good. They were going really, I felt good. I felt healthy. I started losing weight. My skin started coming back. I didn't look like that old drunk woman anymore. My eyes were clear. I could smile. This is going to be good. And it was good. I lost my job in Charlottesville. That was my first major hurdle in sobriety. Now, I engineered myself to get fired. I got fired on purpose. Most people don't do that, but I had another job lined up. And I couldn't take the other job unless I got fired at Charlottesville because it was just a political thing. So, I got myself fired in Charlottesville. The other job, guess what, didn't work out. Isn't it funny how that stuff happens? So I spent the entire summer unemployed. I had no idea how I was going to support myself or my kids, and I was terrified. And I went to AA every day, and I cried, and my white cloud was gone. And all I could think about was drinking. God, if I could drink, the pain would go away. The scary part of my life would go away for a minute. But I didn't. I didn't, because I learned in the rooms of AA that if I play that record to the end, it doesn't end well. So I just kept coming in and getting loved on. And somehow I made it through the summer. I said it in more than one meeting. My bank account reminded me of Christ and the loaves and fishes. Because I should have run out of money. I should have run out of money. And I never did. I wasn't rich. I was barely making my bills, and I'm still trying to make up some of the things that I ran up. But I didn't starve to death. AA and God took care of me, and then I got my dream job. HP delivered my dream job right to me, and those promises started coming true. I work for a mission-based company spreading literacy throughout the world, which is one of the most important things in my mind. I am an executive salesperson. My territory is the world, so I get to spread literacy to third world countries and get paid for it. And that is an exciting, wonderful adventure, which I would have never found with if I had not found the rooms of AA. But outside of all of that, the most important thing that I found is my relationship with my higher power. The most important thing I've ever done in my life to this day, and there may be more important things I do later, was take the third step. And I've been going back and studying the third step recently because I've had some challenges, some emotional challenges, some taking it back. I realized that I was taking it back. Things were too good. Can't be God that's doing it. Must be Laura. And that old alcoholic ego was coming back and getting in the way, and things were starting to feel uncomfortable. And I was starting to feel sad and cry a lot. And I thought, if this is sobriety, why do I want it? So I started studying the third step. I started listening to speakers talk about the third step. And I took my third step again. And what I realized is that for the first time in my life, in 50 years, somebody is taking care of me. For the first time in 50 years, I'm safe. Because every night I go to bed in the arms of my higher power. And every morning I wake up and I say, "Hello, God. I love you." And every night when I close my eyes, I visualize what I want my tomorrow to be. And then I ask God if that's okay. And sometimes it works out and sometimes it doesn't. But I can tell you that the woman that stands before you today no longer considers herself a failure, useless, worthless, and horrid. Every day I try to be a better person. And every day I have to remember one thing. My name's Laura, and I am an alcoholic. Thank you for letting me share my story.